As some of you might know, I spent 8 or 9 years living at Zen monasteries and Zen temples. So the way that I teach often incorporates some of my Zen experience along with my Vipassana experience. So I want to just start by sharing a little bit about a Zen tradition. And it's kind of an aspect of the Zen path. And for students who are really steeped in the teachings and they want to deepen their practice, sometimes they'll take lay ordination. It's called Jukai and involves sewing something called a rakusu, Buddha's robe. Is anybody familiar with this tradition? Okay, so yeah, forget knows. Forget's been around.
I started with Zen also.
Yeah, so a rakusu, it's there's a piece of cloth that goes behind the neck and a little square bib, and it almost looks like it's quilted. And one, it's a very meditative sewing process. And if you live at a temple for a while, chances are you'll take Jukai at some point. And what it really represents is the Bodhisattva vow to live for the benefit of all beings. So when you sew a rakusu, the face of the rakusu is either blue or black fabric, but on the inside is a panel of white silk. And so the student sews the rakusu. It might take a year to sew it. And then when they finish, they give it to their teacher. And the teacher chooses a Dharma name for them. So Mei is actually my Dharma name. It's short for Meikyo Genshin, but that's a mouthful. And I wouldn't get by so well in the outer world with Meikyo Genshin, so I go by Mei. So the teacher chooses a Dharma name like that, and then inks it in with a brush in black kanji on the back of the rakusu on that white piece of silk. And then that the rakusu is given back to the student with their Dharma name in a very elaborate ceremony, where one takes the Bodhisattva vows and lots of chanting and bowing. It's a really big deal, and the person learns their name for the first time. It's a very beautiful thing. All that said, for the teacher, it's pretty significant to choose the Dharma name and work through with the student through this process. And then actually inking the rakusu is a little stressful because you can't use white out, you can't erase, and you can't take out the silk and replace it. And many Western teachers, they're not used to writing with a brush, let alone writing kanji. So it can be a little stressful for teachers. So I was supporting a student through this process, and I had the opportunity to choose a Dharma name for them. And I was practicing when one prepares to ink the silks. You do a lot of practice sheets, just on pieces of paper with ink, and you grind your ink in a little ink stone. And when you do this, you always keep the rakusu like on the far side of the room, just so you don't have any spray. You don't have, accidentally have your brush roll onto it or something. You check your hands a lot to make sure you're not dragging ink over the paper, so you don't want to risk doing that with the rakusu silk. So here I am practicing along, and then at some point I needed to get up just to check the dimensions of the silk face, and somehow as I stood up, my hand brushed a pencil that was on the desk, and the pencil somehow had enough momentum to like dip into the inkwell, bounce out of it, and start flying through the air. And I mean, it could go anywhere in the room. It's a big room, it could go over here, but somehow
Right.
it goes right to the rakusu, and it lands smack dab in the middle of the rakusu with a big black. So the good news is that I didn't lose consciousness in that moment. I survived. But wow, it was very stressful. So, like, what are you going to do? So, of course, it was like, oh God, I got to get rid of this. Like, maybe I can dab it out. Okay, that's not working. Can I wash it? That's not working. I'm blow drying it. Like, how do I fix this? And at a certain point, it just became very clear, I'm not going to be able to remedy this rakusu. I need to accept this and make peace with it. And so I sat down to do the lettering. And so the name for this student is Tokuju Seizan, which is Devoted Jewel, Green Mountain. And so I'm sitting down to do the lettering, and I realized as I started that the scar, the stain on the Rakusu, actually fit perfectly into as one of the letters in one of the words. And it just so happened that the mistake fit into the word jewel. And I thought it was such a beautiful example of the way of something that's really at the heart of this practice, which is turning our difficulties into the way, transforming straw into gold. So in this case, transforming a scar into a jewel, a mistake into a jewel. So that's what tonight is about. It's about suffering, and then how to transform our suffering into the path, into practice, and into awakening. So, when an oyster gets a piece of sand inside its shell, one has to think that's a pretty significant intrusion for a poor little oyster. But what an oyster does with that is it turns it into a pearl. So our task with our practice is to turn the difficulties into pearls, into jewels. So if we're talking about suffering tonight, let's spend a little time defining that. So when I say suffering, I'm using the translation of the word dukkha, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, which is Sanskrit and Pali for suffering. But that's just one translation, and it's not really suffer the word suffering doesn't do a great job of fully encompassing what dukkha actually means. It works, but other words that might be used are unsatisfactoriness, uneasiness, stress. There's a variety of other definitions, but it's really pointing to everything from like the smallest little bit of dukkha, like my socks are too itchy, to like the greatest, most profound forms of suffering that can happen in a human life. It's that full spectrum. And it's happening in large and small ways all day long. And it's actually often going undetected. We're suffering and we don't even know that we're suffering because we're too busy ruminating about what it is that we're suffering of and projecting that suffering onto external objects, right? So yeah, just some examples of some. It might be like, that one conversation from work today, it left me a little insecure. Gosh, if my neighbor was only a little less noisy, or my boss was a little bit more kind, or if only this knee pain would go away, or if I was 5 pounds less, or if I had the right romantic partner, or the right house, or the right car, the right life. So it's the full spectrum. So this is from the suttas. The Buddha on dukkha. He says, "Now this, bhikkhus, monks, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering, union with what is displeasing is suffering, separation from what is pleasing is suffering, not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering." What I'd like to highlight in this, because it's a lot to hear, is specifically not getting what one wants and getting what one doesn't and losing what we love. Because we can spend a whole lifetime trying to just get what we want and get rid of what we don't. Like that's like the sole purpose of our life is to do that. But what we find is it's not actually a functional strategy for happiness. Because desire, the way that desire operates is that it fixates on something. And then even if we get that thing, we haven't addressed the underlying tendency of desire. So desire just finds a new object. And then even if we get that object, well, then it finds a new object. And so it's totally insatiable. So while when we're in our desires, they're so incredibly compelling, and we think, of course, happiness lies on the other side of getting X, Y, or Z. When we back up a bit, we can see that this actually kind of a ruse, like this whole strategy is faulty. And then on the other side of it is getting rid of what we don't want. And of course, we can't control unpleasant experiences. They're gonna keep coming. So to try to get rid of everything that's unpleasant, well, that's not so realistic either. We get rid of one unpleasant thing, and then it's kind of like whack-a-mole. That game pops up through another hole. We, hit it over here, it comes up through another one. So that's how unpleasant experiences are. So are we really going to base a life around just trying to get rid of what we don't like? And of course, like, then there's like the magical times where we've gotten what we want and we've gotten rid of what we don't want. And it's like, yeah, we've won samsara. But then everything's impermanent. And so that passes on. So you can really see with this setup how suffering is a part of life and how wanting and not wanting, this not getting what we want, getting what we don't want, and losing what we love is can really lead to a lot of dukkha, can lead to a lot of pain. So I imagine many, if not all of you, have driven on the 101 up and back from San Francisco. And you may have noticed a very large Buddha statue on the side of the road. Has anybody seen this? I notice it mostly when I don't know that I've ever really noticed it when I'm driving north, but if I'm driving south from SF down here, there's a surprisingly large Buddha statue on the right side of the road. And I've always been intrigued by it, wondering how it got there. I don't think there's a temple there. So it's big Buddha sitting on kind of the traditional little lotus pedestal, which is on top of this very large concrete block. And so some time ago, I saw a photo of it actually from, but it was from the other side. I usually see it from the front going down the freeway, but this photo was taken from the back, and you could actually see that there was a hole, or like an open side to the big concrete block. And I was like, oh, it's a storage area. So typically, with a Buddha statue, it's treated with a lot of reverence, right? So you don't really put things that are dirty around the Buddha or too mundane. And so I was really surprised to see what they were storing in this concrete block. Garbage dumpsters. Yeah, you get a perfect size for these big dumpsters. So what I loved about this is that a lotus, which is the most beautiful bloom, it actually grows out of the mud. So there's this saying, no mud, no lotus. And so there's a way in which this Buddha, like the foundation of this Buddha, quite literally is garbage. Like, it's garbage dumpsters. So it's a little bit like the lotus coming out of the mud. And so in the same way, this garbage is the foundation of that Buddha, we could also say that the garbage of our own lives, the trash that we'd probably much prefer to incinerate and get rid of, actually becomes the compost, or the fertile soil for our own Buddhahood, for our own awakening. So we typically think that our obstacles are diversions from the path. Things like, I mean, if I can get rid of this, then I'll be able to be like smooth sailing on the path. Whether that's some difficulty in daily life or even in our meditation practice, like if I can just stop thinking this or that or feeling this way, then I can have a good meditation. So the shift here is in actually seeing our obstacles as like the very next stepping stone of the path. Like it is our path to liberation. So it's a pretty radical idea that our awakening actually depends on our suffering. But that's the case I'm going to make tonight. It depends on our suffering. And that freedom with suffering, it begins with a change in expectation. So that's the first step, is typically we relate to dukkha, relate to our suffering as something has gone wrong. We're often, I think most people are culturally programmed to see suffering as like a problem, like something has gone wrong. I've messed up. Somebody else has messed up. This is not how it's supposed to be. But instead, can we shift that expectation to realize that we can't insulate ourselves from unpleasant experiences? This is actually a fact of life. And if we can shift our expectations in that way, it can really allow us to open to and accept suffering in a way that we didn't previously. So there's two ways that humans typically respond to suffering. And the normal way of relating to it may sound all too familiar, so you might listen for your own reaction in this. So the typical way is suffering arises and we resist it. We fight it, we try to get rid of it, we repress it, we ignore it, we self-medicate, we wallow in it, we blame others for it, we don't take responsibility for it. So these are all ways that common ways to relate to suffering. So are any of you familiar with the teaching on the 12-fold chain of dependent arising? Okay, so this is dependent arising. I'm not going to go into it much, but it's a teaching that describes the way that we get caught in suffering over and over again, and the ways that when we get caught, it's almost cyclical. We just, we experience suffering, we don't like it, we resist it. That gets us caught in the loop again. We suffer more. So that teaching describes this process of dukkha. The second way to respond to our suffering, and I love this word for it, is to be ennobled by our suffering. Just the word like, ennoble, I think like the word dignity comes to mind. So while suffering often can make us smaller, more contracted, there can almost be like a tendency to fold in on oneself. When I hear ennobled, I don't want to sit up a little straighter to meet my suffering with dignity. So this way of meeting our suffering and being ennobled by it. James Baldwin used to say, "People who don't suffer can't grow up." So, can you allow your suffering to grow you up rather than tear you down? So, our task is to understand our suffering, not to get rid of it. Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, used to say, "Hell is not punishment, it's training." So when you're suffering, rather than relating to it as like, "Oh, this is punishment," or "I've done something wrong," or "This is bad," or "I'm bad." What if we just related to it as training? That this arena of difficulty is actually like our learning lab. Like this is the curriculum. Whatever the difficulty is, like, oh, okay, this is my curriculum today, or this week, or this month. So can we meet our dukkha as a visitor to be welcomed, rather than say, an intruder to be extricated? So don't go to war with your suffering. Don't go to war with it. So while the teaching on dependent arising describes how we cyclically get caught in suffering, there's a parallel list that also has 12 links called liberative dependent arising, or also known as transcendent dependent arising. It's this very beautiful list that ends in complete liberation. And it talks about each step of the way to get there. And each one conditions the next, such that it's a very natural unfolding without straining or striving, just in the way that water might flow downstream from the top of the mountain, just naturally happens. So that's what this list describes. And what's so fascinating about this teaching is what the very first link is. Like, we really want to know what that first link is, right? Because if we can do the first link, then like, hey, this is good news. So the first link is suffering. So suffering is actually the very first condition that leads to liberation. As Joseph Goldstein would say, don't waste your suffering. Because if we're repressing it, if we're ignoring it, if we're pushing it away, if we're hating it, then we're just responding the first way, right? Then that's not liberative. But if we can respond to it in a particular way, which I'll share with you shortly, then the chain gets going. So the way that we transform our suffering as we meet it with mindfulness and compassion. So it's so simple. Mindfulness and just knowing what's happening in the present moment. It's like, it just like, it seems too simple that to be able to do something, like to actually awaken us. But just that really simple meeting of our suffering, knowing what it's like in the body, knowing what it feels like in the heart, the emotional structure, what the thoughts are saying about it, not getting lost in the thoughts, but being mindful of the content. And when we can do that, a real transformation becomes possible. When we can meet our suffering with mindfulness, gladness can arise in the heart. Excuse me, faith can arise in the heart. That's the second link of transcendent becoming, arising. Oh gosh, I really have faith in this practice that this can help me. And when we have faith, oh, I'm so glad. That's the third link. I'm so glad that this path exists, that there's a way to transform suffering. And when gladness arises, that can naturally condition joy. Joy conditions tranquility. Tranquility, when we're easeful, leads to happiness. Happiness conditions concentration, conditions knowing and seeing things as they really are. So when we're still, we can really see the nature of things. And when we see the nature of things, we become disenchanted, which goes to dispassion and liberation and knowledge of liberation. So just like that, each conditions the next, but it all starts with suffering. So this really simple practice of being mindful is so powerful. And just an example of the way it functions. I was sitting on retreat at one point, and I had a really strong storyline going. And what it was I was rehearsing a conversation that hadn't happened yet, but it was a conversation that I intended to have with my boss. And this story just, it had so much gravity to it. The mind was just like sucked into it. And I must have replayed that thought 1,000 times on that retreat. It got me. It really got me. And so without mindfulness, I probably would have just replayed that thought 1,000 times without even knowing I was doing it. It could have been happening while doing the dishes or taking a shower. But I was on retreat, and so I was practicing mindfulness with it. And so, that intention to be mindful started to grow to include what was happening in the body, what was happening with the thoughts as they were happening, not getting lost in the thought every time, but realizing like, oh, what's actually happening here with the thinking mind? What's going on? And then through doing that, I started to see a little bit more clearly, why is this thought, what's going on here? Why is this thought gaining so much traction? And then the mindfulness registered the emotion, and that's what had been left out. The thought had so much, was so compelling, it was really easy just to get lost in it. But as the mindfulness grew and expanded, I realized, oh, I'm anxious. That's what this is. I'm just anxious. And it's the anxiety that's kicking out this thought over and over again. Because the anxiety wants to feel safe. The anxiety says, if I can figure out exactly how this conversation is going to go, if I can rehearse this enough, then I'll be safe and I can relax. And then I can, let go of being anxious. And so the thoughts were trying to fix the anxiety, but of course, the mind can't control how it actually goes. And so what really needed attention was the anxiety itself. So I could let go of the thoughts. And then take care of what really needed my attention, which was the scared one. Take care of the anxious one and bring my kind attention to that. But without the mindfulness, that never would have been seen. It wouldn't have been recognized. So the field of awareness can grow to include all parts of our experience such that everything can be included. And when we do that, we can really start to practice mindfulness in a more effective way. It's not always available. But that steadiness allows us to, can illuminate the experience more fully. And as we do that, through being mindful, often what we see is that what can happen is the mind and heart are purified by the mindfulness. And that purification process can cause compassion to arise. So for many people, compassion is hard to access. We hear like, oh, be compassionate. And a lot of people are like, I don't know what that feels like. I don't have access to that. I can't just like call that forth on a dime. And maybe you relate to that. It's a common thing. And so my response to that is that's okay. It's okay if you don't have easy access to compassion. Through being mindful of suffering, because suffering is a proximate cause for compassion, to really be with our suffering, when it purifies the heart, compassion can naturally arise. So take your time with the mindfulness and just make room for compassion to arise when it's ready. Of course, we can more deliberately do compassion practices to cultivate that state, and that's wonderful also. Here's this is from the Sufi master Pir Vilayat Khan. Overcome any bitterness that may have come because you are not up to the magnitude of the pain that was entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in her heart, each of us is part of her heart and is therefore endowed with a certain measure of cosmic pain. You are sharing the totality of that pain, and you're called upon to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. It's not an easy ask to meet our suffering in joy rather than self-pity. We've had some really good self-pity tracks. And let me tell you, it doesn't work. You may have noticed this. Self-pity does not lead to happiness. There's a way that self-pity actually makes us feel smaller and more isolated from others. There's a sense of like, no one is suffering the way that I'm suffering. And so there's a real important shift that can happen with suffering. Rather than making us smaller and more isolated in self-pity, it actually has the possibility to wake us up to the pain and suffering of all beings, which is actually a very connected state. When I was in my 20s, something very difficult happened. My dad passed. And so, of course, I suffered a lot over that. And there was a way that through that suffering, when I was brokenhearted, the heart, in being broken open, there was room to feel the suffering of all the beings who had lost a loved one, of all the beings who had lost a parent. And so there was a way that I felt that I was able to touch, what Pir Vilayat Khan refers to as like the cosmic pain, the pain of all beings. I'm not alone in my suffering. This is touching the suffering that belongs to all of us and moves through the human heart. So when we can be mindful of suffering, that purification can take place and compassion can arise. This is from Jack Weller, who's done amazing work with grief. He says, the work of the mature person is to carry grief in one hand and gratitude in the other, and to be stretched large by them. So can we be stretched large by our suffering? So large that we can include the whole world in our heart. So it may be that we start this practice just for ourselves, but as we're stretched wide by our suffering and we're present for it, we open our hearts to the world. And then what happens is something miraculous can happen. It's actually possible to be in the world without being afraid of suffering. And so I have a quote for you from Martin Luther King, and I think it's a beautiful example of what can happen when we're not afraid to suffer. To our most bitter opponents, we say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We shall meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we shall continue to love you. Throw us in jail, and we shall still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children, and we shall still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our community at the midnight hour and beat us and leave us half dead, and we shall still love you. But be ye assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. One day we shall win freedom, but not only for ourselves. We shall so appeal to your heart and conscience that we shall win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. Let's sit together for a moment. We shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. One day we shall win freedom, but not only for ourselves. There's actually a prayer that Tibetan monks chant, praying for suffering. Actually praying for suffering, because if we don't suffer, we don't practice. And we need to practice in order to wake up, in order to be free. So they're asking, may I have just the right amount of suffering in order to be liberated. When suffering occurs, sometimes it will ask for a wise and compassionate response, like an engaged action. Like if you had an abusive spouse, I wouldn't say, oh, well, just sit there and be with the suffering. I would say, you get out of that house, move on. And so the teaching isn't just to be with suffering without wisdom indefinitely, but rather to meet our suffering completely. And if it's possible, to meet that suffering without resistance, and from that place of non-resistance, of non-aversion, then take action. That's very idealistic, though. Often we do feel aversion to our suffering. We work with it the best we can. And then sometimes we make a change in life. But what we're trying to do is just, expand our capacity to be with suffering just a little bit longer, just a little bit more. The more we can grow our capacity to be with what's uncomfortable, the greater our bandwidth for being with the full spectrum of human experiences, like the full spectrum of difficulty, without getting keeled over. So what I would say about needless suffering, if you can mitigate your suffering in some way, please do. That's moving from compassion. If you have a gash on your leg, respond to it. Clean it, put a band-aid on it, take care of it. It would be needless to say, oh, I'm just going to sit here with this gash on my leg and wait for it to get it infected. That would be needless. Right? So we don't need needless suffering. Do what you can and use it. Often we can't change our suffering. We can't get rid of this suffering. And so these practices are really supportive in helping us meet those situations and to be with the circumstances we can change until that change actually happens. Thank you so much, everyone.